Counselor Accents Podcast. Two school counselors who love their jobs. Oh, and they happen to have Southern accents too. Bless their hearts.
I'm Laura Rancourt.
And I am Kim Crumbly. And together we are Counselor Accents. Laura, I'm excited.
We have a great guest with us today. And this is such an important topic. Let me tell you what the topic is. Then I'm going to tell you who we have. But the topic is the addicted child. It's about students, adolescent substance abuse. And we have the author of an amazing book, Richard Capriola, with us. And I'm going to deviate from what I said, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about Mr. Capriola. He has been an addictions and mental health counselor for over 2 decades, and he's been licensed in Illinois and Texas, and he recently retired from the Menninger Clinic in Houston, Texas. He was an addictions counselor for adults and adolescents diagnosed with substance use disorders. So we just want to welcome you to our podcast.
Well, thank you. That's a very good summary. you did a great job. Pretty well summarizes it.
Well, you have written a book called The Addicted Child, A Parent's Guide to Adolescent Substance Abuse and the Issue of Adolescent Substance Abuse. I am curious to know where the idea for this book came from.
The idea came from my work at Menninger Clinic, which is a psychiatric hospital in Houston, Texas. And Menninger Clinic serves both adolescents and adults who are diagnosed with mental health as well as substance abuse issues. I worked on both the adolescent and the adult units. During my time with the adolescent unit, I worked with many young men and women who were using both alcohol and drugs like marijuana. And when I sat down with their families, with their parents, and I went over the history of their child's substance use, one of the most frequent comments that I heard from parents was, "I had no idea this was going on." Mm-hmm. Or if they did suspect that their child was drinking alcohol or using a drug, they had no idea of how extensive it was. So this led me to the conclusion that there needed to be a resource out there for parents and for families and for anyone really who is interested in knowing about adolescent substance abuse. What are the topics that will best help them understand this, what can be a complex subject? So I decided to write this book for families and parents and grandparents and anyone who wants to know more about adolescent substance abuse, how to recognize the warning signs, what type of assessments they should get if they think their child is using a substance, how do these substances work in the brain to change the adolescent brain and influence behaviors, and then where can families turn for resources. I wanted it to be a very family-friendly book. I didn't want to load it down with a lot of jargon and technicalities. I wanted it to be a quick resource that families can have, that counselors can use with their families, that basically provides a lot of information to help families to become better informed about adolescent substance abuse and to know what they can do if they're confronted with a child who's abusing alcohol or drugs.
Wow. The work that you're doing, I want to ask you if you have seen a rise in this, but it just seems like we are dealing with so many parents who have children who they're watching addicted to some drug. And it just, and for you to write something for parents to get a hold of that's easy to read, and that helps them. I can't imagine anything more heart-wrenching than to not be able to help your child the way that you want to help them. So I just applaud you for this work. This is, I know for parents out there, this is a godsend for them to have this. So you said for over two decades you've been doing this, what has been the biggest change you've seen over these last two decades?
I think that the biggest change that I've seen recently is young men and women, adolescents, turning more to vaping substances, vaping things like nicotine. So there's been a decline in smoking cigarettes, but a rather alarming increase in adolescents vaping nicotine with these vaping pens that some of them look like USB drives. So there's been an alarming increase over the last few years of teenagers vaping substances, primarily nicotine and marijuana. Marijuana still continues to be the primary illicit substance that adolescents are using, along with alcohol. Those have been relatively stable over the years, but there still is a lot of young men and women using alcohol and marijuana. When we ask teenagers their perception of risk, most teenagers do not see a lot of risk in smoking marijuana. They view it as very, very a low risk activity. So there still is the perception among teenagers that marijuana is not very harmful. The other thing that we know is that if we ask them how easy is it to obtain marijuana, most of them will say it's fairly easy or very easy for them to get a hold of marijuana. So it's easy to obtain, and there's a low risk perception among teenagers of smoking marijuana.
That does sound like a very dangerous combination, the low risk and the ease of access.
It is a very, very dangerous combination. And when you throw in the fact that the adolescent brain is still developing, then we begin to see some serious implications of marijuana use. I dealt with a lot of young men and women who were smoking a lot of marijuana when they came into the hospital. And when I asked them to help me understand why they were smoking so much marijuana, the number one answer that I got from them was, it helps control my anxiety. It helps me with my anxiety. And that leads to a very important issue. If we look below the surface of a child's substance use, or if we look below the surface of their alcohol use, we may very well find an underlying issue that needs treatment. It might be anxiety, it might be depression, it might be stress, it could be any number of psychological factors that lie below the surface. If we just treat the alcohol, or if we just treat the marijuana, and we don't treat the underlying issue, then that child is likely at some point to turn back to the substance in order to medicate the underlying feeling.
That is such a good point. Kim, I saw I saw you and I knew that your brain started going in a million different directions like mine.
The counselor in us, I mean, I tell you, Richard, we have seen, I've been in the school counselor role enough years that I cannot believe where we are in the mental health arena right now with students. I never thought that I would see this much or this change in the mental stability of students. And so I can see the connection with the pain, and if they don't have proper coping skills, they're doing whatever they can to ease their pain. So, you know, I guess have the numbers increased? I mean, are you seeing numbers continuing to increase with addiction, or just the what they're doing is different? Their choice of abuse is different?
I think the numbers have pretty well stabilized. Except, as I said earlier, we're seeing a rapid increase in vaping of substances, particularly marijuana and nicotine. Most of the other drugs, especially the hardcore drugs, they're very low percentages. They may be anywhere from 1% to 2% of, say, seniors. The exception might be in prescription drugs like Adderall and Ritalin. Those tend to go 2 or 3%, but nowhere near the percentage that we're seeing for either alcohol or marijuana. And I think that, hopefully we're beginning to see that we need to look just beyond the substance use. And when we have a child who is struggling with marijuana or struggling with alcohol, to be able to look beyond the alcohol and the marijuana use to see what's the underlying condition that's driving it. There could be a lot of different reasons, but we need to do a comprehensive assessment to figure out what's going on. And my book talks about the type of assessments parents should look for when they turn to looking for some help for their child.
That's a great resource.
Kim, I want you to mention that study that about the information overload that students are having to process. More information.
Psychologists say, and it stuck with me, and I guess it did you too, Laura, when I mentioned it to you, that we are getting more information in a day than they would get in a lifetime 100 years ago. I mean, the amount of information coming in is astronomical, and it, his thought was, and I can't remember who, it just stuck with me, that it's we really aren't wired to take this much in. And I see that in our students, they're getting so much more information. And if they can't cope and they can't process and they don't have those resources, I'm so glad to hear you say, look beneath.
Right.
And look beneath and see if there is anxiety. We are seeing a lot of anxiety, a lot of students with anxiety issues.
I'm not surprised with that. It was the number one reason that many of these young men and women told me that they smoked marijuana. One of the other observations that I noted with young men and women who were smoking a lot of marijuana is we did a lot of psychological testing with them, and their IQs were often superior to above average. Very high IQ students, and they were smoking a boatload of marijuana multiple times a day. But what I noticed also was that the processing speed of their brain was below average. So their brain just wasn't clicking along the way it should be. And their short-term memory was impaired. So if they're sitting in a classroom and a lot of information is coming at them, they're not going to grasp it very well. They're going to miss parts of it. And then the third thing is that they would tell me that the marijuana was curtailing their motivation. So not all of this probably was associated with marijuana, but I'm guessing marijuana contributed to those declines. So it definitely has an impact in their ability academically to stay on top of what's going on, which then creates more stress, which then feeds into their anxiety, which then feeds into their marijuana use. So it becomes a vicious cycle.
Wow.
So Richard, talk to us a little bit about the do you see the suicide among these students with addictions? Is that a fear that parents carry with them that you see, or is that a component, I guess, of this? Is it more at risk for suicide?
I think it's a fear that any parent would have when they first are told that their child is using a drug or drinking a lot of alcohol. I think one of the first things that comes to mind is my child going to overdose? Is my child going to die, from an overdose? So I think that's a natural fear that parents have, as well as then they begin to think, well, how did I miss the warning signs? What did I do wrong? How could I have caught this earlier? And they really start to become very judgmental of themselves. So there's a lot of different emotions that play into what's going on with a parent when they have a child that they learn is abusing a substance. And then they learn also that there's an underlying psychological issue that they were completely unaware of as well. I did write a companion to The Addicted Child. It's a workbook for parents. And really, I wrote this to help parents process their own feelings and to process their own emotions as they go through this journey with their child. So it's a companion to the main book. The main book teaches them about addiction, gives them the information that they need. But the workbook really is for them to process what's going on within themselves.
That sounds like an incredible resource for parents as they do try to...
Because you think about the amount of parent calls that we get for help and to have this resource. And if you do parent meetings or parent workshops, you know, you think about a workbook and be able to put it, to be able to help these parents in that, at that capacity. What a great resource. Yeah, I see the workbook.
I think it's a good workbook, especially if they can process it with a counselor, where they can go through this after working on the workbook themselves to sit down with a counselor and talk about the things that they have written in the workbook and the things that they've processed.
I don't want you to give away a chapter of your book or anything, but I am curious, what warning signs do you think parents should know about when it comes to adolescent substance abuse?
I think parents should be aware of any changes that they see in their child. Pay attention to sometimes what can be subtle changes. For example, you might notice that a child who was once very social now starts to isolate and becomes very quiet. You might notice a decline in academic performance in a child who was getting very good grades. Now the grades start to decline. You want to pay attention to any changes in your child's appearance. A child who used to take pride in the way that they look no longer cares about the way that they look. Change in friends. You might have a child who was very open with their family about who their friends were. The family knew their friends, now becomes very secretive about their friends. So there are all of these warning signs that parents need to pay attention to. But to summarize it, just parents need to be aware of any changes that they see in their child's appearance or behaviors or attitudes. Those may indicate something's going on below the surface that needs to be examined.
And that's for educators too. We just went through a situation with a student. Unfortunately, we saw all the signs, but to get the parents on board was a different story. So it's great that when you have parents that will work with you and you know, that will do the hard work and yes. Then fortunately often that's not always the case. But I'm glad there's resources for parents and I think for educators too, because those are the signs we're looking for also.
Yes, I agree. I think it's a good resource for parents, I think for family members, for teachers, and for school counselors. It not only helps teachers and other school personnel understand the basics of adolescent substance abuse, but more importantly, it gives them a resource that they can share with parents. And that might be the first step to educating parents and leading towards getting an assessment and treatment is by helping parents to be educated about adolescent substance abuse.
Well, and that's a good lead-in to my next question for you. If a teacher or a parent does suspect that their child is using alcohol or drugs, I'm sure as the student gets older, maybe the parent finds it more difficult to insist that they do something, but what would you recommend? Where would they start with getting their child some help?
I would start with having a conversation with the child. And depending on the relationship that's been built over the years, that might turn out to be a very productive conversation. You might learn as a parent things that you didn't know before, like, you know, your child is smoking marijuana because they have a lot of anxiety or they're under a lot of pressure. If you have built up that kind of relationship over the years with your child, you might have a very productive conversation. That might then lead to, okay, well, what can we do to help? In a lot of cases, you're not going to have that kind of a discussion. You're going to have a child who either denies that they're using, or they become rebellious, or they just object to even talking about it. Then I think you have to insist upon what I describe in the book as a comprehensive assessment. And most likely your child is going to resist that. They're not going to want to go in for any type of an assessment, and you just have to insist that it be done. And the book describes the kinds of assessments that parents should look for. Obviously, you need an addictions assessment from an addictions professional. But you also need a psychological assessment to see what's going on underneath the surface. And you need a good comprehensive physical exam to make sure that there's not anything physically that might be contributing, say, to their use of a substance or to any underlying issue. So it's a series of assessments, not just one, but a series of assessments, which when they're all put together, lead you to a comprehensive diagnosis and a treatment plan. And then the treatment plan is going to guide you in terms of what the next steps are. There is no one size fits all. Some kids can do very well with outpatient treatment, where they see a counselor. It might be the school counselor, or it might be another counselor, and they'll do very well. There are other situations where the substance use is more severe, or the underlying emotional issues are so severe that you may be looking at some type of residential treatment program. A lot of the kids that we saw had a very severe underlying psychological issue, and they had a very serious substance abuse issue. Those kinds of kids usually were sent off to a residential program that might go 6 to 12 months. So a lot of it depends on the results of the comprehensive assessment and the final diagnoses that are made.
Do you find, Richard, that this is often a family issue? I know it's a family issue because it's their child, but is it often more than just the child and the family involved, or the others? Are addictions inherited or in our gene makeup? I've always heard that, but I don't know that that's true.
Well, I think that's a very good point, because although addiction might affect one member of the family, it has ramifications for the entire family. So the entire family system is affected. I think there are very few things that are more disruptive to a family than having someone who's addicted to drugs or to alcohol, especially if that's a child. So the whole system is involved in the substance abuse. And it's not unusual that the whole system, the entire family, might need help and support, might even need treatment.
That makes sense. And we often see the ramifications. It's not our student, but we often see it's we're dealing with the effects of other family members who have addictions, and we're trying to help the family other family members cope, for sure.
Yes, yes.
It's so true. I was talking to a counselor just last week, and she said, it's really not the student, it's the whole family. If we could just get the parents and the whole family in here, we'd make more progress. So, yeah.
I think that's a very good point. And, you know, it you may have the child that has the substance use issue, and a lot of times the family wants to point to that as being the primary problem, the kid. Mm-hmm. You know, if only the child would stop smoking marijuana or would stop drinking or would stop using drugs, everything would be fine. And unfortunately, it's not that simple. Many times there are family dynamics and family issues that are involved that also need treatment.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that. And I can also, when you said that a child will do this to cope with their own anxiety, I'm thinking, I wonder what the parents, you know, do they have a lot of anxiety that they're showing the kids, or what are their coping skills? What are the parents' coping skills for anxiety? So that's a very curious point.
Well, I think the entire family probably is subjected to a lot of dynamics that go around, but unfortunately, the attention tends to get focused on the kid, and a lot of these underlying issues that might be affecting the family itself often go unnoticed. So much attention is placed on the kid that the other issues either get ignored or are not acknowledged.
Yeah,
I can see that.
So, Richard, where do you think we have, and maybe we haven't, maybe I'm not asking this in a fair way or a right way, but where have we failed these children? Have we failed them in our society or in educating them? Where do you think there is a flaw in this?
That's an excellent question. So much has changed over the years in terms of the expectations that we have on teachers, the expectations that we have on counselors, the expectations that we have on kids going to school. It's much different now than it was 20 or 30 years ago. And also the availability of drugs is much more so than what it was, you know, 20 or 30 years ago. And even simple drugs like marijuana have become much more powerful and much more potent than they were, say, in the 60s and in the 50s. So there's much more risk to these drugs. They are much more powerful. They are much more available. Adolescents, you know, for things like alcohol and marijuana, don't perceive a lot of risk to them. So I think a lot of it comes down to education, to help children understand what is going on. When I worked with young men and women, adolescents who were smoking a lot of marijuana, it did me very little good to lecture them about the fact that it's an illegal drug. They already knew that. Or to tell them they shouldn't be smoking marijuana because they've heard all of this. They've heard it from their parents. They've heard lectures on you know, that it's illegal, that they shouldn't be doing it. And quite frankly, it doesn't mean a lot to them.
Yeah.
But what I did find impacted these kids was the neuroscience of addiction. When I talked to them about how these drugs affect their brain, I had their attention.
Wow.
That they were interested in. They were curious because these were fairly bright kids. So they were very interested in learning, how does this drug, marijuana, affect my brain? So I would show them a picture of a brain, and I would show them the different areas of the brain and what that part of the brain was responsible for. And then I would show them where marijuana attached itself to within the brain. And they could very quickly see that marijuana attached itself all over the brain, and they could draw the connection between, okay, now I understand why it affects my short-term memory. Now I understand how it can affect my motivation and my coordination. So what captured their attention was the neuroscience, learning how these substances affect their brain and how it can therefore affect their performance. And when I caught their attention with that, I was able to negotiate with them a period of time when they might consider suspending their use.
Wow.
That is so Interesting.
And
it didn't do me any good to tell them to quit smoking because they weren't going to listen to me any more than they do their parents or their teachers or their counselors. So what I did was negotiate with them a period of time where they would be willing to suspend their use. And I would have them set the period of time. So they might come up with 3 months or they might come up with 6 months. And I would say, okay, you agree that you're not going to smoke marijuana for 3 months or 6 months, whatever they came up with. And I said, when you've done that, go back and get retested. And I'll bet that you will see some improvement in your short-term memory, in the processing speed of your brain, and your motivation. And when you see those improvements, then you can decide if you want to go back to using it and risk losing all of those gains or if you want to just keep going. And I was betting most of them, because they were fairly bright, would make a decision at that point that they didn't want to return to using the drug.
There is so much to unpack right there. And Kim, I knew that your mind, we know each other. And so I knew that your mind was going crazy too.
Yeah.
You empowered those students to make their own decision. It's not someone making them quit their use of the drug or alcohol, but you gave them the choice and empowered them. And I love that. I love that you know to do that, or that you thought to do that. That's genius.
Most of them responded favorably, and they thought it was reasonable, and the foundation was set by helping them to understand the damage that was done by marijuana, and that they had an opportunity, if they chose to take it, to do an experiment, so to speak, an experiment to see if they stopped for a reasonable period of time, if they could reverse that damage. Most of them decided they wanted to.
That's awesome.
And I didn't realize, please don't tell my addictions professor from my counseling program, but I didn't realize that you could reverse that damage. So that's very interesting to me.
Well, you know, this applies to even adults, but our brains have a remarkable capacity to heal themselves. Once we stop pushing alcohol and drugs into the brain, the brain has a remarkable capacity to heal itself. A lot of the healing depends on the drug that was taking, how young they were when they started, and how long they used a substance. But once we stop using a substance, our brain has a remarkable capacity to heal itself, and especially the adolescent brain, which is still developing, you can see some pretty remarkable improvements after a short period of time.
That's hope.
Yeah,
and you, part of what we do as school counselor is to educate students on the dangers of alcohol and drugs, and a lot of that is done in a particular week that we spend and hit that very heavy, generally Red Ribbon Week, and I know not everybody call it that. That's what we call it, Red Ribbon Week. Mm-hmm. You know, you think about using material that works, and so that makes sense that they can see with their own eyes, because like you're saying, a lot of the things that we tell as counselors, it's illegal, and it has to make sense to them. So that's a great tip on what will work when we go in to talk to these students.
I knew your brain was going there. I knew it was.
Because you hate to use things that are not going to work, you know,
right.
And especially you want to get this right. And Richard, I have told you this, Laura, but one thing that I have found in doing this is 10 years ago when I went in to students to talk about drugs, I would get sniggers and almost, you know, what is, you know, like they're giggling, you know,
snickers,
and they're like, they're so cool. But these last few years that I've gone in, it's not funny anymore. It's not funny to them anymore. And it's because it has hit our community so hard that it's their mother, it's their daddy, it's them themselves. It's become so real now, and they have seen how it has destroyed families that they know. I mean, it's just like, it's not, it's just this sad reality, and it's So I have seen a change in my own, where I live in my own community with students in the way that this information is. I love what you're giving us to say. I think that's important, but I have noticed that it's hit home. It's hit every family. Mm. So they know it. They know what I'm talking about.
I want to go back to something that you said a minute ago before Kim changed the subject and took the talking stick away from me.
I did not take the talking stick away. You need the talking stick back.
Okay, thank you. I love the phrase, when you ask them how long did they want to suspend use, I can see the power in that phrase of suspend use, because you're not telling them they can't do it again. But what I'm hearing from you is that most of the time they saw the improvements and they made the choice themselves. But I think the suspend use, that was a very powerful statement to use.
I wanted them to understand that they are in control, mm-hmm. that the decision is theirs. Because if they make the decision, then they're accountable, mm-hmm. Rather than me make the decision. So many times they've had other people make decisions for them that it's important that they make the decision. Now, I wasn't going to let them get by with saying, well, I'll quit for a week or I'll quit for 2 weeks. I emphasized that it had to be a reasonable period of time, because what we're looking for here is for them to give themselves a chance to see improvement. We already know from testing that the processing speed of their brain was below average. We already know that their short-term memory is impaired. We already know that they've admitted that using marijuana has reduced their motivation. So now we have some standards that we can compare it to in 3 to 6 months. So you tell me how long you are reasonably willing to suspend your use of marijuana. And, they might pick 3 months, they might pick 4 months, whatever they picked. And then I would say, when you're done with that period of time, get reassessed and look at the improvements that you see. And then you can make a decision as to whether you want to give up those gains or if you want to continue to build upon them. And I was guessing that most of them would choose to just keep going. But they maintain the final decision, and they maintain control of, how long they were going to suspend their use.
Wow. Richard, the book says the addicted, this book may save your child's life. And yes. What a need and what an important work. And I appreciate so much you coming on our podcast, because, we need more just rubber meets the road. Here is a practical guide. Here's a practical workbook that can help you. And just in talking to you, the ideas that we've been given on how we can help our students. So I see this is an award-winning book. We'll have a link to it. Laura, anything else on what we're going to add here for him, for Richard?
We are going to add a link to it. I do want to ask one more question. Our audience is mainly school counselors, but we do have lots of different types of educators. And Kim mentioned the phrase rubber meets the road, and that is what we love. We love for our listeners to come away from our podcast with a rubber meets the road. I can implement this. I can do this now. So I'm curious to know from you, what measures could school counselors especially take to be proactive? I don't know how to phrase my question really, but how young should we start in educating students, and what do you see that we could do more of as school counselors?
I think you can do two things. I think the younger we can reach these children as counselors, as teachers, to begin educating them about particularly the neuroscience of substance use and how things like alcohol and drugs affect a maturing brain so that they get a better understanding of protecting their brain over the years. And I think that begins at an early age and then is reinforced every year by teachers and by counselors. I think it's just as important that we educate families, and that's a role that counselors can take the lead on, because you have a line into families, and so do teachers. But counselors are able to approach it from a counseling perspective. So if there's one thing that that I would suggest counselors do is take a more proactive role in terms of educating families. Maybe hold some sessions with family members, just education sessions. Use the addicted child as a resource for families. And just begin to put a lot of emphasis in helping parents understand what goes on with alcohol and drug use in an adolescent, how to recognize the warning signs, and what to do when you see those warning signs. So it's an approach that educates the child, but also puts just as much emphasis on educating the families. And that's pretty much why I wrote the book, was to educate families. And as counselors, I think that you can play a very important role in educating families and maybe heading off this before it becomes an issue where, you know, families are in a crisis situation.
So good.
Yeah. Thank you, Richard, for this important work. And, you know, Laura, I've just got chill bumps thinking about our listeners, and this is going to hit somebody.
Yes.
This is going to change somebody's life. I you know, even counselors have family problems and issues, and I don't know that this might not be for a school counselor in their own lives, but definitely we can use this in our program. So thank you for your work.
Yes.
Quite a mission that you have, and I can imagine the stories that you have and the life you have led doing this and the pressures and the stress that comes with this job. But, you know, just God bless you for your work and for coming on and sharing this, and we thank you for this resource.
Well, thank you, ladies. But I can't do it alone. It takes dedicated people like yourselves to help, you know, carry this forward, to spread the word, and to work with people. So I really appreciate you taking the time to interview me about this book, and even more importantly about this issue of adolescent substance abuse. So I applaud you for the work that you do. I know it's not easy being a school counselor and working with families and kids, but you do have the power to change people's lives and to affect kids' lives.
Thank you for those inspiring words. We appreciate that. And I know the educators out there listening appreciate it also.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, ladies. Have a good day. And thanks once again for taking time to talk to me.
Thank you.
Kim, was he not just a wealth of information?
I want to say font of information.
You say that, and I always feel like I need to tell people what you mean, because
I don't need you. If I need you to translate for me, I will give you some kind of signal.
Where I come from, we call it fount, but whatever.
That. Okay. It's the accent. I hear it. I was saying font.
You said font. And a font is what you choose when you
create. I need. Okay. So I do hear myself, you know, as we're fixing to talk about how we're ramping up our social media, I videoed myself, which I hope everybody will see, getting my HelloFresh box yesterday. And I heard it when I played it back, and it said, "Here's some meatballs." I thought I need to fix that so I don't say meatballs.
I heard it on you, and this is a gentle correction. But I heard it on you whenever we did that most recent WASTC.
Yeah.
Other girls, they sounded so eloquent and together.
Yes.
Here's you and me talking about, now my earrings are the size of, I mean, whatever.
Embarrassing.
Well, I
embarrassed me.
Well, but you embarrassed me too. I was doubly embarrassed.
I could not be more embarrassed when I hear you speak. But I did hear, I am saying that I did hear myself, mate, bow. Why? I don't know.
Well, let's move on. So we just had a wonderful, wonderful podcast about something that is so important and impacts so many people. And I would just like to say we're coming up on the 1 year anniversary of us doing these podcasts, Kim. That's exciting.
It is exciting. And
who would have thought we expanded beyond your mom and my mom?
Well, literally when we started, we said, we know we have two.
Right.
For sure listeners. And that proved to be untrue. I don't think my mother has ever heard me. Well, I even say, Mother, watch, Alexa, play Counselor AdSense podcast. And, oh, yeah, that's easy. But she ain't going no trouble.
Gotcha. And my mother has an iPhone, but it's like the iPhone 1, because that's all she needs. She still can't even work that.
That's the same. She's good with that. No, my mother just don't care. I wish it was a tech issue, but, you know, I meant, no. I've got it, push the button, say the word, and it comes up. So anyway, for everybody else that's listening, and I believe we were voted the number one podcast, may I say, in the world for school counselors, or would that be an exaggeration?
Please say it.
I think it was for the United States. So I don't know if they're doing this in other countries and we, you know, but we were voted the number one in the United States podcast for school counseling.
Thank you. Whoever voted, my mom, your mom, whoever voted.
They were voting. They're just not listening. So anyway, it has been a wonderful journey and we have got to meet so many incredible people in the education world, in the school counseling world. And
can you please hold off? Let's don't do our recap. I was just telling you that to be
excited. I just am getting a little clavamp. Is that a word? Like when I'm getting that. I'm getting that a little emotional.
All right.
Well, I want to say I look like, if for those who, I wish you could see me, I look like Velma often. I look like Velma with this sweater off of Scooby-Doo.
Like Shaggy.
Well, that was a worse situation I was in today. I looked like Shaggy. Today I'm Velma.
You really nailed that. Yeah. No,
thank you.
Which Scooby-Doo character will you look like tomorrow? We'll have to wait and see. All right. Well, it's time for us to make a few promises to our listening audience. Are you ready?
Yes, I'm scared.
Well, first of all, I just want to say, guys, buckle up, because the upcoming episodes that we have are incredible, huge. I mean, big name people. Can I say that?
Yeah, you can.
I mean, I just didn't know. I don't want to blow anybody's cover, but I am so excited. And it's topics that, I don't know, that are needed. And I'm just really, really excited about this upcoming season, because now we're going to be moving on to season 2 of Counselor AdSense Podcast.
Yeah, I'm excited too. I'm very excited. And what we have in the hopper is some exciting episodes. So,
yes. And again, it wouldn't be possible without you all listening to us. So thank you so much for listening. Here's another promise that we're going to be making to our audience. And this is on you. But we are going to be ramping up our social media presence because Kim has finally learned how to work her flip phone.
Gulp.
Yeah. Kim has some anxiety. I have anxiety about birds, but Kim has anxiety about social media. And
I do, because it's like I'm Phoebe from, Friends up on the table singing Smelly Cat. I don't have a... don't say this, don't do this. So I don't know what I, you know.
I have said it often that Kim and I, we could not be more opposite. When we go into a room, Kim wants to own the room, and I have to pinch her frequently to tell her. So it is interesting to me that you have this awareness that you need someone to pinch you, but you don't know how.
I do. And I always say before we go into any function, please stop me. Get me down off of the table. And I'm not talking about alcohol involved at all. I'm just saying I can't stop. It reminds me of when we went to eat and this man and his wife were sitting beside us that we knew at another table, but he was totally ignoring me and I couldn't stop. I wouldn't leave him alone. And I was looking at you saying, please help me to stop. Please help me shut up. I can't stop. So that's my fear for social media is like, I will be, you know, like we don't want to see that. We'll hear about your dog and you said to stop me. You said to stop me.
Well, we are going to be trying to share more of what we have going on because we do have a lot going on. And we love connecting with all of you. And we have a Facebook group that so many of our friends, they have now become friends and family, it feels like, but they are in that Facebook group. And I don't know, we've been separated. We are separated by distance, but I really believe that when we see everybody like at ASCA this summer, fingers crossed, that it is going to be like a family reunion and that as long as we can all hug again, I can already feel the hugs, Kim. I feel them.
I am so excited.
But anyway,
I'm so excited.
If you're not in that group, we want you to come be a part of our family. We also have Instagram and then we have our Facebook page, not our group, but our page. And so you're going to be seeing a lot more of us and we apologize in advance.
Thank you. As long as you're apologizing in advance for my increased social media presence, I'm okay.
Okay. Anything else?
I think all hearts and minds are clear.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. We will see you next time.